Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Teaching with Class podcast, the podcast that gives you quick, actionable tips to easily implement in your classroom. I'm your host, Kate Klein. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about meeting the needs of every child in your classroom. It's a big job and a very important one. So how do we ensure that our classroom is a place where all children are welcomed and valued and supported? And how can we get help when we or the children need it? Well, today we are joined by Jill Cook, an educator with over 30 years of experience in the field. She's been a classroom teacher, a family childcare provider, a preschool administrator, and now works as a diagnostician in a public school system here in Texas. And other fun thing about this conversation is that Jill is also my very good friend. We started teaching together in the same school 30 some years ago. So I'm really excited to have Jill join us today for this conversation because she can offer so many things to guide us as we try to meet every child's needs. So let's get started. So hi, Jill.
Hello.
I'm so excited to have this conversation with you today, my like friend of forever and educator, administrator, diagnostician extraordinaire. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
It is going to be fun.
All right. So, you know, we're talking today about really like meeting every child's needs. And we always start with a story, right? How do you personally connect to this topic of, you know, why it's important to meet every child's needs? Tell us the story.
Well, I think it comes back to a time when I was a classroom teacher and in a classroom setting, and you walk in and you're just so excited the first day of school, you're going to change the world, right? You've got all these little kids and you're going to change them. And then you find out, oh, some of them are a little difficult than others. And it's harder to change them. And you need a lot of help to get that done. And sometimes it does take a community, not just one person in the classroom to do that. But I've been there. I've been in that same position that some of these brand new teachers are in, or teachers that just have had groups of kids that haven't fallen into that category of needing extra support that's above and beyond what they can give within the classroom setting.
Yeah. So a real, like, I've been there, done that, ready to hear and ready to help. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. So introduce yourself. Tell us about you, your background and all, what you want us to know about yourself.
All righty. Years ago, I graduated from University of Northern Colorado back in Colorado and immediately took a teaching job in Texas. So I have been in Texas ever since, but my work in early childhood has taken me in a lot of different directions. So I did start as a classroom teacher in one of the larger school districts in Texas and then moved into a position where I was a certified in-home child care provider. That allowed me to stay home with some of my young kids at that time. And then a job fell in my lap that allowed me to be a director of a small preschool. So I did have the opportunity to do a lot of onboarding and training for new teachers, working with children between the ages of 18 months and 4 years. And then after that, I did take another position back in a public school setting where I did work primarily with kindergarten and pre-K students. And after that, I decided to go back and get my master's to become a certified diagnostician. So I kind of have played a lot of different roles in the world of education, but I feel that I have stayed true to my passion of working with young kids. I've always been around the early childhood students.
Yeah. And I remember when you were wanting to find that next step in your career and you were deciding between like, do I want to be a special ed teacher? Do I want to be a diagnostician? Like, and you were trying to figure out what was the right direction to go. And it was really speaking, this particular need, right, was really speaking to your heart.
Yes.
Anything you want to say about that big shift that you made?
I think one of the main reasons I made the big shift is as a preschool teacher, you're the first ones that get these kiddos into your classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And you're dealing with students who maybe are coming from a traumatic background, mm-hmm. maybe are coming from a background with some sort of a speech delay, maybe are coming from a background with some significant academic deficits, just not, you know, up to par academically, not picking up skills, a developmental delay of some sort. And sometimes we're the first ones to approach the parents yeah. with our concern.
Yeah.
A lot of times I felt like I didn't have answers. Parents would come back at me with question after question. Why? Why aren't they acting like the other kids? Why aren't they making the progress other students are making? And I felt as a classroom teacher, I didn't always have the right answer, or I didn't always have all the information to provide them.
Yeah.
So moving into a position of a diagnostician, I feel has allowed me to gain more knowledge mm-hmm. that I can share with parents
mm-hmm.
and in turn work closely related with, you know, more closely with them in helping their own child.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Wow. We've got all these different perspectives that you're bringing today to this conversation. So let's say what it is we want to cover in this conversation. We really want to talk about from the educator perspective, like you just said, I've got all these kids in my classroom. What do I do now? Kind of thing. And how do I make sure that everybody's getting their needs met? And maybe I can do that. Maybe I need to reach out for some help. So we're going to talk about that kind of thing. What do I want to notice? What do I want to keep track of? How do I reach out for help? What do we expect? And those kinds of things. I'm going to just offer this caveat. We're going to avoid specifics because reach out to this specific person or that specific role, because we know every right program and system is a little bit different, but we can offer some general guidance about that. And that anyone listening should figure out, right, who's the person who does that thing where I work, right, that I right. can reach out to. But in addition to avoiding those specific technical things, are there any other things you might think might come up, technical terms or words that we want to try to bring up now that we can try to define for people?
I think there's just a lot of special education lingo mm. when we start getting further into some of our conversation
okay.
about now what do we do if, you know, that student doesn't look as if they're progressing like their peers and reaching out for assistance through
okay.
possibly looking at the special education realm of it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of acronyms.
Yeah.
but I'll try not to speak in acronyms. Okay.
We'll try to avoid the alphabet soup and define them. If we run into them, we'll define them. So awesome. Yeah. So let's jump in. Let's imagine, right? You and I, we started in our classrooms 30-something years ago
yes.
at the same school. And we can identify with educators that are getting ready to welcome their new class of students this year. And so we want to think about with them, what are some ways that we can get everything going to set everybody up for success? So what are some basic building blocks, right, for meeting children's needs? What's basically good for all kids?
Oh, my goodness.
It's a big one.
I know. That's a big question. really, with the younger ones coming in, I think one of the main points to keep in the back of your mind as you're entering your new classroom is setting up a sense of community with those children.
Mm. Yeah.
I think if you are setting up that community, showing the children respect, being fair and consistent in return, you are going to receive respect back from them.
Mm-hmm.
I think children need to understand from day one what your boundaries are.
Mm.
We all know how kids will push.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of that setting up your community. Kids are going to know from the very start, am I going to feel safe in mm-hmm. this environment?
Mm-hmm.
If I push, how far am I going to go? They're going to know, I can keep pushing and pushing and pushing. or they're going to know, oh, I can push this far. And then the teacher is going to set that rule and stick to it. I think there's just a lot of setting those appropriate boundaries for kids.
Yeah.
Because if they don't feel that sense of security or safety in their environment, they can't take in the knowledge that you're providing as well.
Yeah. So we need to decide ahead of time if we have boundaries that are boundaries in how we relate to each other, what's okay and what's not okay, and how we get along with each other. And then maybe some, any thoughts about that? Like, how do I decide what those are in my classroom? What do I pull from to think about those things?
Well, you know, pull from your early childhood development information, right?
Yeah.
Should a early childhood classroom be silent? Absolutely not.
Right. That would be hard.
That would be hard, right? So your boundary can't be, or set that rule of, oh, no talking.
Right. Well,
we need to communicate. We need to enhance those speaking skills in young children. We need to provide a very language-rich environment, and we all know that.
Yeah.
So I guess it's determining at what level of volume you're comfortable with as a teacher. Also, knowing that those social interactions between kids aren't always positive, right?
Yeah.
What you have, I want.
Yep.
What you're doing, I want to do. You know, they're gonna invade each other's space. They're gonna cause conflict with each other because that's what young children do.
Yeah.
And understanding that, knowing what is my boundary, when am I gonna step in and facilitate that conversation, and when am I gonna stand back and allow them to try and solve it. You know, just really behavior management.
Yeah. Yeah. So
what am I comfortable with in that realm of my knowledge for early childhood development?
Yeah.
With creating that safe space where kids can learn and grow.
Yeah.
But do it in a way that is not chaotic.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have sort of want to set clear expectations for behavior and how we're going to keep track of that and foster it, model it, follow up about it, all those things. And then we might also have some expectations for like where things go and how we do things around here. Right. And that's all that part of sense of community. So, okay. So I've said all those things and I got my kids and we're doing stuff. And I'm noticing, like you said, there's things that happen. They're just learning. I've got to repeat things, especially the beginning of the year. I'm going to repeat stuff all the time.
Yes.
And we're having some conflict because we are just learning the rules and how we do things. And I'm managing those things, right? I'm reminding, I'm redirecting, I'm modeling, I'm doing all that stuff. When should I kind of start to worry about a child not figuring it out, or something's happening, I'm starting to have a feeling like, ooh, this is something to worry about.
Right. I think it's something that teachers really need to pay attention to is how often that behavior or that they're not learning, how often is that happening?
Okay.
Like, and then the duration, how long does it take for them to be able to calm back down? I have one that's tantruming, right?
Yeah.
Is this a regular transitional period for that student? And now I think teachers need to be very aware and start tracking certain behaviors and certain aspects of what they're concerned about.
Yeah.
Simply just watching to see how often is it occurring?
Okay.
How long does it take for them to be able to self-regulate? Or even if they can't self-regulate, how much intervention is needed so that they can calm down. And also the intensity. Are these behaviors, is the intensity decreasing? Then perhaps you're doing the right thing.
Right.
You know, you're providing that emotional support. You're providing the words to say. You're providing the modeling and the skills. And now they're starting to implement that themselves, and they're using these skills. And so they're working through these emotional aspects, I guess, of starting school, transitioning, sharing with all these other kids.
Right. I'm not the only one. I'm part of a group.
Ugh. Right. Yeah. It's like, oh my gosh, there's 19 kids in this classroom with two adults. I'm used to me at home with mom.
Exactly.
So, you know, just watching, is this going to be something that the student is going to be able to kind of take the skills that you're providing them and manage in this environment? Or is the intensity increasing? Is the duration of it getting longer? Mm-hmm. Is the frequency? Are they now tantruming 3 and 4 times a day when they were only tantruming 2 or 3 times a week?
Right.
And I think to understand which direction these kids are moving, data is so important to collect.
Yeah. So how do I do that? Right. I want to make sure I'm collecting good data and useful information that will be helpful in the long run. So what should that look like?
Right. It can be super simple, and there are going to be people, on your campus or at your school that are going to have all kinds of behavior tracking charts. There are lots of simple ways to be able to track different types of behavior. It does not have to be difficult. It can be super quick as a tally mark. Mm-hmm. So on a simple chart, you might want to pick 2 or 3 behaviors that you're concerned about. Mm-hmm. And you may even only have 1 behavior you're concerned about, and that's all you're tracking. So, you know, think about, what is that 1 behavior I see that I'm concerned about, mm-hmm. that doesn't seem to be going away after they've transitioned into a new setting,
right?
Or seems to be continually be getting progressively more intense,
right?
More frequent,
right?
Lasting longer.
Okay.
So simply just tracking how many times this is happening a day or per week with a tally mark.
Okay. I was wondering about, because you mentioned also children who have language or learning, you know, challenges in that progress also. How do I kind of keep track of those things?
Yeah. Reach out to possibly a speech and language pathologist that's on your campus or in your school, or, you know, contracts with your school. And they've got a wealth of information about articulation sounds that are appropriate or not appropriate. Expressive language information, like, is this expressive language a deficit for the student? They're not, you know, you ask a what question and they answer it with a why. You know, are they not truly understanding me, or do they just throw out words? Or,
yeah.
You know, that expressive language, and even the receptive language, like, I'm asking you to do this over and over, and you don't seem to understand what I'm asking. Mm-hmm. Are they not receiving the information properly?
And whether it's like maybe they have a different first language, that's not right. We have to figure that out first.
Correct.
Like, you know, that might be impeding their receptive
ability. That would certainly be a language difference, not a language deficit.
Right.
So yes, absolutely. First determine, you know, is this a language difference? How often are they exposed to the English language as opposed to another language? And then if you've determined it's not a language difference, then you need to start looking into, is it a language deficit?
Okay.
Sometimes simple conversations with a parent, you know, contacting the parent and finding out, hey, how much English are they exposed to at home? You know, but then when you realize, oh, this might be a language deficit, simple questions might be, you know, give a parent an example of what you're concerned about. Take anecdotal notes and ask, you know, share that story with the parent. Hey, when I asked your child this question, here's the response I got. The response isn't always matching the question. Do you hear this at home?
Can you give me like a concrete example of something like that? I asked one question and they answered it with a completely like, that's not the way I would have expected that person. Right.
So after reading a simple story, you know, what was the dog's name? Do you remember the name of the dog? And and the student says, the blue house I go to.
Yeah. Wow. That's
okay, we just sat side by side and read this story that every page had the dog. The dog's name was Buster.
Yeah, you know? Right.
And then you reword it and you ask them again and you show them a picture. You know, remember, here's the dog we saw when we were reading the story. Remember, the dog had a name. What's the dog's name? And they might answer, I go, park.
Right.
They're just not making a connection. And if you realize through, all your interactions day by day, you're going to realize whether kids are connecting with what you're doing or not.
Being on the lookout for that.
Like, yeah.
So, okay. You mentioned talking to parents from the diagnostician perspective. Yes. And also, right, you're a parent and a teacher and all those things. Like, what are things that are helpful to say or ask, and what are things that you're like, please don't say these things, when you're talking to a parent?
Right. So from the teacher point of view, of course, anytime you have a concern about a child's development, it's always good to call a parent, share some of those concrete examples, just the fact. Yeah. You're sharing the fact. You know, if it's behavior, those are tough conversations to have sometimes with those parents.
Right.
But it's much easier if you've written out anecdotal records and you keep your own emotion out and it's simply the fact. That's what you want to share as a teacher. From the diagnostician point of view, it becomes the waters get a little muddy if a teacher has mentioned a possible diagnosis.
Okay, like what does that mean?
Such as, wow, you know, your child has a really hard time being still. They can't sit for 30 seconds while I'm reading a story. Have you ever considered ADHD?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That is, yes. As a teacher, do not, even as a diagnostician, nobody in the school district in the state of Texas can diagnose ADHD. That is a doctor diagnosis.
Interesting.
So using those words that indicate a diagnosis, like attention deficit disorder, or even something like, well, I think maybe they should be getting speech therapy.
Oh.
That's, you know, a teacher can't make that determination.
Right.
A teacher can certainly say, here's some of the questions I've asked, and here are the answers I get. Or they can say to a parent, I find that I am constantly having to ask your child to repeat things because I can't understand what they say. Do you find that other people outside of your family do the same? You know, so you can have those conversations to find out, is this something that is happening between school and home? And are parents, have parents ever been alerted to this before, and are they concerned about?
That's a good point about like people outside of your, you know, the regular people this child interacts with. Because families, we get very used to the way things are, and we don't always recognize like, oh, this might be a little outside of the typical. So, if I want to be a really good, you know, teammate for this child, getting the support they need, who are the people, like I've kept some good data, I've had like a very careful conversation with a family, who else am I reaching out to try to get some support for this child?
Right. Good question. So when you realize, and you've got some of that data that indicates that this child is not quite on the path of their peers, and there are some concerns, whether it's academic or language or behavior, the next step would really be to reach out to the person who kind of does those referral meetings, meeting about next steps for that student, a meeting that would help determine whether that particular student might benefit from a special education evaluation.
Okay.
And every school, every campus should have a team of people that come together. As a diagnostician, I find that I have to be very separate from that team at first. That team is the one that is going to be asking the teachers for the data, not the actual assessment people. The reason being is when you're in that referral process, looking at that possibility of moving forward with special education. The evaluators have to take a step back for a moment because we can't predetermine any type of a disability. Mm-hmm. So when you're in that process, you are going to your general education designated person and providing them with all the data that they know will help facilitate a good referral.
And they might ask you to capture other data. They might come and observe in your classroom or something like that. So let's just say an observation is part of, you know,
the referral process.
What should I expect or do or avoid doing when, you know, because like part of me wants everything that ever happens to happen when that observation happens so that somebody can see what I'm dealing with every day.
Right.
But it's like unethical to like harass a child, right? It's not right to do that.
Make them show
right?
their behaviors. Right.
So what do I do? Yeah.
Right. Well, let me back up just a minute before we go into what to do, because the observations for the referrals are going to come from the teacher data.
Ah, okay.
Because that's prior to an assessment person getting involved in the process. So those observations are going to be very anecdotal, just simple things that the teacher needs to jot down throughout the day. You know, keeping in mind to also jot down what happened right before the behavior occurred, and then what happened right after. So kind of that antecedent, the behavior, and then the consequence, those A, B, C charts that are out there that you can Google and find.
Right.
They help facilitate and make it easier to capture that data. So the teacher's information is going to be shared at the referral meeting. In the referral meeting, there will be assessment personnel. Then the assessment personnel look over all the data, question the teachers about the data, and they determine if the assessment is going to move forward or not for special education.
Right. Okay. So
then when a special educator has gained consent from a parent and is able to go in and start the evaluation with that student, that's when they will go into the classroom to do those observations.
So when an
assessment personnel comes into the classroom, it needs to be as natural as possible.
Okay.
We like to be the fly on the wall. We're not going to let the student know we're there to watch them. If kids ask me, what are you doing here? My response is always, I'm checking out what happens in a pre-K classroom today. You know, I'm not, I'm observing Johnny.
Yeah.
We never want that student to know you are there to observe them, because then the student acts differently. But you just want to see a natural day. I know the behavior, we all know as assessment personnel, we all know we might not see the behaviors that are documented.
One.
That's why that data is so, so important.
Okay.
Because if this is the student who's having tantrums, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a day, that's lasting 25 minutes each, you know, for the most of their day, they're tantruming. And then that 1 hour window we go to observe and they don't tantrum.
This happens to be.
We've got all this data to prove that, yes, it does happen, even though we did not see it in that 1 hour window of time.
That
was important.
Awesome. Okay. So, and then I have to make sure the data that I'm gathering is objective and, you know, it's just, you're saying the facts, what happened, right? What was the situation? We were trying, you know, the request was to line up or something like that. And then this happened and then the consequence was that. Okay. And so then, so my question, because the time is going so fast, here's the reality though, is like you said, there's 19 kids in a class, and more it feels like more and more of those children need something extra, right?
Yes.
And some kind of support, a wide variety of things. And that can feel very daunting as an educator. Like, I've got, you know, 10 of my 19 kids have something going on. Anything that you can offer about, like, not getting discouraged about really trying to, that you're doing the right thing, trying to meet everybody's needs, and how we come back to that each day, because we know educators care so much. Yeah. What are your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. First of all, as an educator, give yourself some grace. Mm. Give yourself some grace. Understand that some of these behaviors are not because of you, right? The children, they're bringing their own background to the classroom. Right. And some of them just have had traumatic background.
Yeah.
And we might not understand that. So sometimes we think, oh no, this is because of me. I'm, you know, initiating all this in the classroom and it's causing this child to behave like this. No, it's not because of you. And they are not doing it to hurt you or towards you.
You're right.
Because this is how they can react and they don't know how else to react.
Yeah.
So understand that, you know, don't take it personal. It's not you. So take that whole emotion out of it as making it personal. The other thing I'd like to remind everybody is we have a large community of peers and we all have our separate areas of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Go have thoughtful conversations with the other educators that you surround yourself with.
Mm-hmm.
One person in the classroom is not going to have all the answers for a variety of different behaviors. Go speak to the specialist who deals with behavior or the counselor or the AP or whoever it is on your campus. Get ideas. Try something new. Because if what you're doing day after day isn't helping the student, it's not helping you. Go have that thoughtful conversation and accept that help. Put in place some of their advice.
Yeah, try it out for sure. Oh my gosh. I sure hope that we covered so many different things. So we're wrapping it up and I just want to finish up the conversation. And maybe you already said this as you were offering your other thoughts, but I always ask our guests at the end what you would say, like if you could connect with any educator out there, right? From your heart to their heart, what kind of encouragement would you offer?
One thing I think that always comes to mind is that grace. Give yourself grace, right? Second of all, always put the student first. And we know that, right? I think we get caught up with all the other stuff about being a teacher.
Yeah.
And we forget that what we truly need to focus on is the student. We are in the field of education, hopefully, because it is your passion. And it is not just a job. It is who you are. Remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so beautiful because that's where you started. You said, no matter where I've been, you know, in all the different roles, it's always been about the children, right? So that's awesome. Thank you so much for joining me today and having this conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Wow. We really covered a lot of ground in that conversation. Really thinking about how to set up the classroom, our expectations about behavior and how we do things in the classroom so that we build a community and make our classroom a place where all children are welcome. And then how do we keep track of things when we feel like a particular child might need some extra support? How do we engage with that team that will help determine what the child needs? So we've covered a lot of things today. I hope that you also are keeping close to your heart Jill's encouragement about giving yourself some grace. So remember, thriving educators create environments where children can thrive. So please take care of yourself because what you do matters. You can find today's episode and the transcript on our website, teachstone.com/podcasts. Thank you.